The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to television writer Mark Guggenheim, who's currently on the staff of the CW hit Arrow, and who previously has written for The Practice, Law & Order, Brothers and Sisters, and Flash Forward, which my wife loved.
Cool.
He's just published his first novel, Overwatch, and it is one scary Orwellian ride through a CIA agency even the CIA doesn't know about. Stick around. This guy's got more than one arrow in his quiver.
Very nice.
Had to make one stupid
arrow. That was great. Remark. I love that. Right. Very well done.
Okay. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's been 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of DC Comics characters such as Black Lightning, Bouncing Boy, Red Tornado, and the Wonder Twins, patiently waiting their turn to be selected by the CW so they can be considered cool once again as well. In the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. I don't know what it is with guys who write for modern TV dramas, but they can imagine government conspiracies and intrigue where I just see incompetence, waste, and feather bedding. Take Mark Guggenheim, for example. By day, he's on the writing staff of the most excellent superhero drama, Arrow, on the CW. It takes place in a world of corporate intrigue, government corruption, and, oh yeah, this guy with superhuman physical attributes and an astounding talent with a bow and arrow. By night, and weekends, I suspect, Guggenheim is now a writer of fiction as well, having just published his first novel, Overwatch, about a super-secret, out-of-control spy agency operating within the CIA without the CIA even knowing of its existence. Its unlikely star? A young attorney, Alex Garnett, desperately trying to get out from under his father's shadow, which is a little tough when your old man is also a lawyer and one who has served two presidents as Solicitor General and Chief of Staff. Why a lawyer? Let me think. Possibly because that's what Guggenheim was before giving up Boston Legal for Hollywood and Vine. Now, I've interviewed a series of novelists of late with deep roots in TV and film, and all I can say is keep them coming. These guys know how to write a fast-paced thriller. Mark Guggenheim, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for kind words.
Oh, my pleasure. Anybody who writes a book that I cannot put down is welcome on this show.
Cool. Well, I am honored to be among those people.
Well, you earn your place. I mean, this is a major page-turner of a book. When you write something like that, are you going on, is that the type of book you like to read? Is that the type of book you would like to read? Is it a natural extension of, the kind of TV writing you're doing now with Arrow? Fill me in a little bit.
Yeah, no, I definitely write stuff, and this goes to my television work, my comic book work, my film work. I write the kind of stuff that I want to see or read, and Overwatch is definitely an example of that. I'm a big fan of, Tom Clancy and John Grisham and Scott Turow, and it's, I sort of set out to write a combination, like a hybrid of the, legal thrillers that I enjoy reading and the techno thrillers that I enjoy reading. It's sort of like, how do I make a Reese's peanut butter cup? How do I, take two great tastes that hopefully will taste great together? And that's sort of, what Overwatch became.
That's so funny. When you said that, I thought of something I hadn't thought of in 30-some years. I remember being a teenager comic book fan and thinking, well, what a great story it would be if I could write, like, a story where the Thing meets Superman, meets, you know, Deathlok, meets whatever, and, you know, just throw it all together. And why can't I do that? Oh, there's licensing issues, of course. Yeah. But, you know.
And every now and again, they get around those licensing issues, and they do a really cool intercompany crossover. I really hope they'll get back to that at some point.
That was fun. So, okay, so I was going to ask you about this later, but apparently you have some comic book interests.
I do, yes. I'm a big comic book fan.
Uh-huh. I know you can't say here that you're a Marvel guy working on a DC show, but you want to tell us a little bit about your comic book influences?
Yeah, you know, look, I mean, I've actually had a lot of experience writing for both DC and Marvel. I just happen to have a DC gig at the moment, and the comic books that I grew up with and the comic books I read to this day are it's probably an evenly balanced mix of DC and Marvel. So I'm very agnostic as far as my comic book loyalties are concerned.
Now, I didn't realize until you actually brought it up. And I'm going to point out to people, yes, you'll be hearing a lot of banging behind me. Damn contractors are working, and they were supposed to be done hours ago, and with nothing we can do about it. Tell me, I didn't know that you wrote for comics.
For DC, I did runs on The Flash and Justice Society of America.
Oh, cool.
For Marvel, I did runs on Wolverine and Blade. Spider-Man. I've worked both sides of the street, and I've also done some creator-owned stuff as well.
Wow. Yeah, I had no idea. Tell me about the creator-owned stuff. Don't skimp on details here.
Well, I did a book for Oni called Resurrection, which was basically every alien invasion movie you've ever seen. The series begins 5 minutes after all those movies end. So we kick the aliens off the planet, we're victorious, but now what? And it deals with the mystery of, well, why were the aliens here in the first place and what drove them off? Was it really us or was there something more mysterious going on? I also did a book at Image with my wife called Halcyon, which is about what happens when the never-ending battle for truth and justice finally ends and all evil and crime in the world is expunged. What happens to all the superheroes?
Very cool. Yeah, I had no idea. I must say, I read this very carefully. There's no mention on the back here comics.
Yeah, I had to be a little, economical in terms of listing my background.
Oh, no, you know what? I apologize. It does say on here. I missed that. It says, yeah, writes comic books, Spider-Man, Wolverine, The Flash. And I missed the other line. They worked on the Green Lantern movie, but maybe you don't want me to mention that.
Feel free. Happy to talk about.
I thought that movie worked to a certain point, and then it kind of went off the rails.
You know, it's one of those, you know, it's one of those interesting movies where I think a lot of people have different opinions, and rightfully so. And you know, it was an interesting experience for me because, you know, as a screenwriter, You spend a long time writing a movie and you do several drafts and then at some point you inevitably get replaced. And then, you know, another writer comes in and sort of does their thing to it. And yet it's still your name on it. And because there's still like key elements that you brought to the table, it's a weird experience. Like your kid, like you start raising the kid and then at some point the kid gets raised by a foster parent. You know, and then the kid either becomes a Indian chief or a serial killer, and you sort of, you know, go, okay, well, what's my level of responsibility? You know, I never begrudge anyone's opinions about anything I work on. That's, you know, what makes the world go around.
I'll come back to Overwatch in a second, but I didn't know about this. So where were you in the writing process for the Green Lantern movie?
Greg Berlanti, Michael Green, and myself all wrote several drafts of the movie, and then the studio brought in a writer named Michael Goldenberg to do what's called a pass on it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's sort of our involvement, or was our involvement.
Well, Goldenberg, since Guggenheim is in front of me, I'm blaming what I didn't like about the movie on you, goddammit.
Well, you know, I what I love about the magic of the internet is that if you probably did the most rudimentary Google search, you could read our original first draft. And, you know, I'm always like, you know what? I always let the work speak for itself. So, it's out there for people to discover on the interwebs.
Well, so kind of bring this around to Overwatch. How does your experience writing for comics and for Arrow, for that matter, how does that affect when you take on a novel for the – I don't know if this is the first one you've published or the first one you've attempted.
No, it's the first one I've ever attempted, it was quite an undertaking. My television and my comic book work, I guess to a certain extent it conditioned me to think in terms of a driving narrative and in terms of act breaks. I mean, the truth is the novel, yes, it's got chapters, but it also has a film-like structure to it. There's what I would consider to be a first act, a second act, and a third act. And that's just, it's not necessarily by design, it's just sort of the natural outcome of the way I've learned to tell stories. I think even if I were, let's say, write a television show for premium cable where there are no commercial breaks, I think I would still naturally, at least I hope, would build in act breaks just so that the narrative is flowing with ups and downs and twists and turns. Certainly comic books, you know, your monthly issues, those are your equivalent of act breaks. Mm-hmm. You just do it long enough and certain storytelling conventions really become ingrained in you and you don't necessarily chuck them once you work in a different medium.
Did you organize and plan out Overwatch in the same way that you would to a TV script or a comic script, or did you do anything differently?
Yeah, I had a very detailed outline, I've sort of learned the hard way over the course of my writing career that I write without an outline at my peril. At the same time, I always give myself permission to deviate from the outline, and Overwatch is no exception. I don't think I've ever written anything in any medium that was a perfect translation of the outline into a script. Mm-hmm. There's discovery that happens along the way in the writing process that, quite frankly, if you're not making those discoveries, usually there's a problem. I'm very much the kind of writer that when I'm in the pages and I'm actually thinking with my fingertips, I discover things. I feel like my IQ actually shoots up a couple points because I'm just smarter. When I'm physically writing as opposed to breaking story.
Hmm. Well, plus I know a lot of writers who work in fiction or what have you, or related, you know, film, TV. Once you start writing and you develop these characters, a lot of writers feel that the characters take them where the story needs to go. No outline can do that, because an outline can tell you, I want to start here, I want to build the action, I've got the rising action, I want to come down a little bit, cool things off a little, and then take off again. Fine. You know, at A, act A, you know, action B, whatever, that doesn't develop the character and the breadth of the character until you actually start typing, putting words in that person's.
Exactly. Yeah. It doesn't become dimensionalized and real until that starts happening. That's very true.
Now, a feature film script, typically about 90 pages, I think.
Oh, gosh. If you're lucky, for a feature film script, 100 is my target usually. Mm. 90, it's very hard to cram that much story into 90 pages. Around 100 is the, you know, and 120 would be your absolute high end.
All right. So what I was going to say is, so that for like a feature, maybe, I don't know, how many pages for an hour of Arrow, for example?
Anywhere between, I would say, 50 and 55 is the ideal.
Okay. And so here you are with a novel, and let me just check the page count here, folks. Bear with me. almost 300, about just under 300 pages, I think. Yeah. And the difference is for a script for even for comics, I would think, it spreads out. You know, here's the name of the character. Here's what he says. Yeah. Some writers are going to put in what's happening, the action. Some are not. They're going to leave that to somebody else. here in doing fiction for the first time, full-length fiction, you've got to fill in all that stuff. Was that a challenge?
It really was, actually. I think one of the big lessons – I learned so many lessons working on the novel, and one of the lessons I learned was that I've had it easy in all the other mediums I've worked in, because if I'm writing a screenplay or a teleplay and I want a character to walk into an office, I just write interior office and the time of day, and that's it. Maybe one sentence just to set the scene. But in a novel, you have to describe the paint on the walls, and you have to describe, is there crown molding, and is there carpeting, and all these things that you kind of take for granted and sort of outsource to your in the case of the set, like the production department or the locations department, you're responsible for. And it's an interesting challenge. I have to say, there's pros and cons to every medium, and the pro in a novel is, well, it's not getting interpreted by anybody else. There's no actors, performing it. There are no artists drawing it. It's all on me. The downside is it's all on me.
Right. I make my living writing nonfiction.
Oh.
And I have been wanting to tackle fiction. I worked on one with another guy. We did a novel and then another book that had elements of fiction to it. But I got to say, it's just the opposite. Well, it's sort of the opposite for me. I can write 300 pages of nonfiction, fact-based stuff. But the idea of sitting down and having to create from whole cloth scares the crap out of me. And I haven't been able to get over that hump. And I admire that you were able to go from the scripts, film or TV or comic scripts, to the whole novel, because it's got to be a lot of it's a challenging thing.
Well, it took me a while, and there are definitely like sort of fits and starts, and it was also learning a new medium, so I had a steep learning curve to conquer. I would like to think that my next novel will go faster just because I've learned a lot. And I learned a lot about the process that I need to have in writing a novel and all that jazz. So it was an interesting experience for me, to be sure.
Did now the book world is very different from the screen world. Did your screen experience buy you any cred with a book agent, or did they
It's a good question. I don't know. I think you'd have to ask my book agent. Basically, what happened was I wrote the first half of the novel, and I had my outline, so I knew where I was at the midway point. You get to the midpoint of a novel, at least I did, and you go, oh my God, there's still a whole other half of a novel to go. In the case of Overwatch, in my first novel, I had no idea if it was any good. I had no sense of perspective. And, I guess I wasn't interested in taking the leap of faith necessary to finish the novel before showing it to anybody. Hmm. So I sent it to my agents at WME, and they were like, well, we're TV and feature agents. What do we know about reading novels? But we've just merged, as it happens, with William Morris, who has a whole bunch of book agents. So they sent the half manuscript on to my book agent at William Morris, Erin Malone, and she read it and went, yeah, this is pretty good. I can sell this. I still have her email, her first email to me, because I'm like, I just want proof that that's actually the case. And sure enough, true to her word, she did. She sold it off of that first half, as well as the remainder of my outline. And, then I actually had to finish writing the darn thing.
Mm. Now, you have written lawyers before, TV. I can't remember now. Is it Boston Legal, or was it The Practice that you worked on?
The Practice.
The Practice, okay. The real Boston Legal show. Yeah, The Practice. I like that. I never got hooked on the other one.
Legal.
Yeah.
I think it's David Kelly's birthday today, actually.
Happy birthday, David.
Happy birthday, David.
We may be the only people on the planet thinking of you today.
I
doubt that. I think that's probably not true. Have you? How often do you go to that well of writing lawyers or writing, you know, characters that are lawyers?
It's a good question. I don't know, because it doesn't really happen by design. I don't say, oh, now I'm going to write lawyers, or now I'm not going to write lawyers. It just kind of happens. It's a convenient thing to have. But, you know, I would say now my work is, I would say predominantly non-lawyer. You know, even on Arrow, you know, I joked when we pitched the show to the network, I joked that we made Laurel, Katie Cassidy's character, an attorney, because my contract guarantees me one character who's an attorney, so I have no problem writing that character. But even Laurel, you know, as much as she's an attorney, doesn't really get into the courtroom all that much. Every now and again she does, and it's very handy to have that background. But you know, sometimes I, you know, find myself on projects where the characters are lawyers, and other times there's not a single attorney to be found. I always sort of welcome it when there are attorneys involved, because it is, you know, something that's very much in my wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. And I do like the world of law. I've always been fascinated by it. It's why I became an attorney in the first place. And I do feel like it's good fodder for drama. I was a big fan of The Practice and David Kelly's writing long before it was, you know, his birthday or before I worked for him. You know, and I like that milieu.
Before it was his birthday. That's pretty funny. It's good that you remember that, though. That'll always...
I'm actually amazed that I remember that. That April 4th is his birthday. Weird.
Good karma remembering something like that, I'm sure, for a guy who's still working TV. Now, Alex Garnett is interesting because as we meet him, we instantly are struck that he's a smart guy. He gets the law, has a good instinct for it, but we don't exactly get a sense – I didn't get a sense that this is an overly ambitious guy. It's a guy who wants to break out from his father's shadow, but it's not like he – you don't get the sense that he really wants to work that hard. Maybe that's why he's always in his father's shadow. He's not reaching hard for it. He's sort of – I don't want to say he's an anti-hero, but he's not. He's not
Jack Ryan,
right? Right.
You know, Jack Ryan sort of comes on the page, and he's like he's the perfect dad, and he's perfect in anything he's ever done, whether it was being a bond trader or being a CIA analyst or president of the United States. He's just perfect through and through. He never screws up.
Right.
I wanted a protagonist with some feet of clay who wasn't just. Who just wasn't perfect, you know, and you would go, hey, you know what? That's not always the right call to make. You know, I like flawed heroes, not necessarily anti-heroes, but flawed heroes.
Well, and he goes through early in the book, the CIA, he's got to go through the psychologist at the CIA or the psychiatrist, I guess. And they've analyzed him. They've got his weaknesses. So they've never come to the point in hiring him where they think he could be this guy that he sort of becomes as the book goes on. There's no evidence in his life or what he's done to suggest that he could be this guy.
Yeah, that's true.
You know,
I think that's sort of the, you know, I mean, it's a little bit the classic Campbellian hero's journey, that the protagonist starts off with being someone who has a lot more potential than he or she is currently accessing. Mm-hmm. And some people notice that potential and other people don't. It's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty standard trope, if you will.
You know, guy most likely to whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
What you know? Do you see yourself in Alex at all? Is he?
You know, it's funny. I don't actually. I probably don't see as much of him in myself as I should, and I say that because maybe there's a lot of him in me that I'm just not self-aware enough to see. You know, because obviously I've asked myself a lot, particularly lately as I've been promoting the book, what is it about me and my psychology that made me want to write this character who sort of had these parental issues that are actually kind of different from my parental issues? I got plenty of parental issues, don't get me wrong, but Alex's are very different. And, I do think that there's some deep seated psychological reason why I chose to write about these particular parental issues. except I don't know what they are. I haven't had enough therapy, I think, at this point to be able to answer. Hopefully by the next novel, I'll know.
So your dad was never been the chief of staff for a president or so?
Interestingly enough, no. I don't think my parents have had the kind of experience that sort of parallels anything close to what I've done in my life. So I'm not operating their shadow by any stretch. It's
nope.
Weird.
No parents who were lawyers?
No lawyers, no writers. It's very strange. My father owns an electronics store and my mother works for a caterer. So about as far afield from what I do as you can get.
But very admirable professions. We're very proud of you, Mr. and Mrs. Guggenheim.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Everyone, me and my two brothers, we're all writers. And everyone's always wondering or asking, how the hell did that happen? It's very, very strange. We're all writers and we're all products of, I guess, an entertainment culture growing up.
Interesting. Yeah, it's weird. I only realized in the last year or two that my brother and my sister and I'm the oldest of the three, we all wound up being self-employed, which I hadn't really put together except in thinking about my father, who was almost always unemployed.
Interesting.
And yeah, so it's just influences different.
Well, maybe sort of looking at your dad, all three of you went, you know what, I'm not going to cede responsibility for my employment or lack thereof to other people. I'm just going to take it upon myself to always make sure I can't fire myself, you know.
If we're going to do this, I need to lean back, all right, and you need to take notes. So at what age did I first think that my father was an unemployable slob? Well, Dr. Guggenheim, sorry. what about this aspect of the book, the Overwatch, the idea for people who haven't read it yet, is that deep within the CIA, there is this other kind of CIA. We know that there's all kinds of black ops groups out there. We hear about these things. We don't know for sure. but Overwatch is this group that has a completely black budget. They kind of peel off money from the real CIA. They have no one oversees them. The head of the CIA supposedly doesn't know who they are. The president doesn't know about their existence. And they do whatever the hell they want.
Yeah.
You freak me out. What can I say?
Well, I have to say, I'm very fascinated or very interested by the world that exists in plain sight outside of our world. Mm. Sort of call it subculture, call it shadow organizations, call it conspiracies. I'm very interested in the idea that there's all this stuff going on that is right under our noses, really, that none of us know about. I just think that that's kind of interesting. And I also thought that in a book that tries to sort of marry espionage with law, it would dovetail nicely with this other topic or theme that interests me, which is what really is law? What really makes something legal versus illegal? And is it simply a matter of legislative fiat, or rather, is it a question of morality? Can something be legal and still wrong? Can something be, right and still illegal? And the Overwatch, without sort of spoiling the novel, I think raises that question, which is what exactly is right and what is wrong. And I'm fascinated by that as well, as I think probably most people are, certainly any attorney.
Well, I think, I don't want to devolve into politics here, but I would think that a Dick Cheney or Donald Rumsfeld feel that what's legal is whatever they can get away with and not be challenged on in that case.
Yeah, I think some people, absolutely some people, subscribe to that feeling. Some people also sort of subscribe to the feeling that they just exist above the law. And don't really sully themselves with concerns of, well, this is legal or illegal. And in some ways, I think that's the Overwatch. The Overwatch exists outside of the law and certainly is not spending a lot of time thinking about whether or not their conduct is right or wrong. They're not engaging in those sort of moral debates.
Hmm. Now, what about, are you a conspiracy buff in general? Do you live for a good conspiracy, or was this just, is this writing, or is this coming from some other place?
You know, it's funny. I'm fascinated by conspiracies, but my interest in them is really confined to fiction. I actually don't buy into conspiracy theories in real life. I just don't think it's possible to keep a secret in this day and age to the extent necessary to pull off a lot of conspiracies that you would read about. As a subject of fiction, where keeping secrets is possible, or at least it's part of the willing suspension of disbelief that I bring to the subject as both a writer and a reader, I'm totally interested and very fascinated by.
What I mentioned at the top of the show that I've had a lot of writers on who are in TV and film lately. Drew Chapman's got a book that just came out called The Ascendant. And it's the idea is there's this other agency within the government, and they're planning for stuff. And that one also freaked me out. It's just like – and the problem is it becomes – when these stories, this fiction is so believable – and it meshes so well with what is reality that you could believe that this could happen. That's where you've got to keep turning the pages. You've got to know how it's going to turn out.
And I think unlike comics or novels, comics or film or television, one thing I've noticed is that the bar in terms of believability is a lot higher in a novel. Mm. You know, the reader's willing suspension of disbelief is lower. And I think the reason for that is the nature of a novel, it requires you to describe things in such detail that if it's not feeling real, the lack of detail or the presence of false details or details that ring false, they stand out like a sore thumb.
Right.
And so your bar is a lot higher in a novel, which is a long way of saying I had to do a lot more research. And then I would have to do for a television show or a movie or something.
So let me just throw a theoretical at you. So if you were writing a story about a guy with an incredible six-pack mm-hmm. abs.
Okay. I think I might know where you're going.
With you know, a great talent for, oh, I don't know, threading a bow in an arrow. Could you write that as believably as you could Alex Garnett? Could you make us believe that that guy in fiction? Now, because I mean, I can watch Arrow and believe that that guy, you know, exists in the television universe. But
yeah, well, that's sort of what I mean. It's like, you know, could you do Oliver Queen as the protagonist of a prose novel? I think you could. I think you'd have to work really, really, really hard to pull it off. I think you'd have to. There's physical attributes. There's aspects of his training that you'd probably just have to work harder in terms of research and in terms of description to really sell. But for sure, it's a lot easier to do in the narrative, in the medium of television. Different mediums have different pros and cons, and different strengths and weaknesses. And one of the things I always try to do as a writer, working in these different mediums, is match the right project to the right medium.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
So let's change gears a little bit. So sure. You started your career as an attorney in Boston. What was the first writing opportunity you had that kind of, you know, started making you think, maybe I don't need to be an attorney?
I had been, you know, writing on the side since my third year of law school, and I wrote this romantic comedy called Musical Bears, and that script got me a lot of meetings in Hollywood, and it eventually sold, but it only sold after I already like broke in and started working on the practice. But before it sold, it just got me a lot of meetings, and that was, you know, to answer your question, the thing that made it, it wasn't a gig, but it made me feel like, oh, you know what, maybe there's an audience for my writing, and maybe I can actually do this. Mm-hmm. So it was. I wish I could say that I quit my job with a job in Hollywood already in hand, but that was not the case. I went cold turkey on the law and moved from Boston to Los Angeles, really with just the hope that I'd get hired to do something. And as it turns out, that turned out to be the practice, and that was my first paying gig.
That was my next question. Yeah, that's amazing to jump from that to that. I mean, it makes sense in that you've got the legal training, you have the background, you were in Boston. Gee, A Boston lawyer just walked in the door of the practice. Who would have guessed? Maybe he'd have a shot.
Out very well. Yeah. It was even more right place, right time than that, because at the time David was launching Boston Public, and he was going to have three shows on the air along with Ally McBeal, and he wanted to hire writers on the practice who were first time writers, but also who used to be lawyers. And I think just the fact that I had been practicing in Boston where the show was set was just this added benefit. But I was already lucky that I was a first-time writer who used to be an attorney coming in the door. So it was very much right place, right time.
What season was the practice in when you joined?
Season 5.
Okay, and it still had two more to go?
Yeah, actually, I got poached by Law & Order after the end of my first year. So I only did 1 year on the practice.
Wow.
And I never, if you had told me that I would get a job on the practice, the only thing that would be less believable was the idea that I would leave the show to go work on another show. But Law & Order, you know, I mean, the thing about working for David is, you know, it's very well known that he does the vast majority of the writing. With Law & Order, they were offering me the opportunity to really, you know, see more of my work produced. It turned out to be a good move for me, because that's where I met my wife. So I'm glad I switched.
Very nice. Well, where does Law & Order shoot? Don't they shoot in New York?
They shoot in New York, but the writers were always in Los Angeles.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, the writers and post-production, editing and everything was all in Los Angeles.
Right. So how long with Law & Order?
3 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Then I went to go work on a show called Jack and Bobby. That ran for 1 year before, unfortunately, getting canceled. And then I went to CSI Miami.
Oh, I didn't know that one. Okay.
And then, from CSI Miami, I went to a show called Injustice, which was created by Robert and Michelle King, who created The Good Wife. That also, unfortunately, got canceled, at which point, I worked on Eli Stone and Brothers and Sisters.
You worked on Eli Stone. Interesting.
Yeah, yes.
That was an interesting show. There was the singing lawyer who saw and heard George Michael and wound up becoming Sherlock Holmes.
It was a little ahead of its time. Here, I'll show you. Hang on 1 second.
Yeah, okay.
I got a prop here. This is a gift my brother commissioned for my 40th birthday. Eli Stone action figure.
Oh, that's cool. That is so cool.
That remains on my desk, and I have my Eli Stone mug here.
Nice.
Yes, with all our little quotes that we set around the office.
How fun!
So Eli is never far from my thoughts.
Is it weird for you to see him on
Elementary?
Elementary, thank you. Yes,
A little bit, you know. But also, I mean, I've been doing this a reasonably long time, and you know, seeing actors in different roles doesn't shock me the way you know it used to.
I've told this story on the show before, so I'll keep it brief. But yeah. Elementary, I wanted to hate it something awful, because the only book I've ever had be purchased by Hollywood was a book called The Profiler, and Warner Brothers optioned it for Jerry Bruckheimer. And the year that CBS selected Elementary, it by the end of pilot season, it came down to two shows, one of which was going to get picked up, because they didn't have a lot of opportunities. The profile, the name was changed to Trooper, and it was starring Mira Sorvino.
Oh, yeah.
And it went right down to the last day, and they went with Elementary, and we thought we had it made. Come on, who's going to buy a Sherlock Holmes set in New York when you've got Benedict Cumberbatch doing it for the BBC? But, you know, as it turned out, it's an excellent show, and I
had no idea you were involved with that.
Well, I mean, I co-wrote the original book, and I would have just picked up the checks, but you know. But what are you going to do?
Maybe one day.
Yeah, maybe one day. We'll keep battling. So you've had the experience in Hollywood of being on a show for a season, then for three seasons, but you've all and the stability that comes with that. But then you've also had the experience of the excitement of getting on a new show, and then you know it doesn't. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've experienced both. I've kind of at this point, I think I've experienced everything. I've experienced working on a show that became a hit. I've worked on a show that you know, tanked and was dead on arrival. I've worked on a show where I got fired. I've done everything. Done it all.
And you worked on the Green Lantern, which
– And I worked on the Green Lantern.
A whole lot of stories there too, I'm sure. Are there days where you miss the somewhat more steady paycheck and guaranteed living of the law?
No. Really? Not at all. No. In fact, you know, when I left the practice of law, the very next day, I knew I was never going back. And it wasn't the steady paycheck. I mean, I've actually been really lucky that I've worked consistently in Hollywood for, you know, 14 years now. And I've never felt like I wasn't getting a steady paycheck. Even when a gig has fallen apart or a show has gotten canceled or whatever, I've managed to work. So I've been very lucky, knock on wood. But every now and again, I miss the adrenaline rush of going into court. That was always a lot of fun. But overall, the lifestyle, the billable hours, the 80-hour work weeks. And I think also, back when I was practicing, I think I was a pretty decent attorney, but I always sort of felt that I had reached the limits of my capacity in terms of my skill set. And as a writer, I have a better sense that this is what I was meant to do. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Now, I'm assuming that, you know, working on a weekly series, especially now that you've got some all the experience behind you, different shows and everything, the pay would be decent. Why do – now, as an old comic book fan, you know, a comic book geek loves the idea that you write comic books, but – I assume it doesn't pay anywhere near commensurate with working on Arrow, for example, or...
No, it definitely doesn't. I generally speaking, manage my career according to the principle that I don't think about the money. I've taken one gig in my career for the money, and it turned out to be a big mistake, and it really taught me never do it for the money.
You're not referring to being on this show, are you?
No, I don't think I'm getting paid for the show. I haven't taken a gig for the money. But for comic books, for sure, I do that for the love of the game. It's not how I'm making my living. But I love writing in the medium, and I actually really love the people. People in the comic book industry are just wonderful.
I'm assuming that, the appeal of doing like a, Halcyon, I think, was the one you mentioned,
uh-huh.
and the other one for Resurrection. That the part of the appeal there is that you might come up with something as a creator own that you can sell into another medium.
It's funny. I haven't done that yet. I mean, we had Resurrection had been optioned by Universal a couple of years back, and. We sort of played around with a movie version, but it's a nice thing if it comes about, but it is not and should not be the raison d'etre of doing a creator-owned project. Mainly because you can't count on it, and I think just think it's sort of folly to sort of hope, especially also since honestly, like I'm at the point, fortunately, that if I want to set up a movie, I don't have to do it as a comic book or a novel first. I can just go and set it up as a movie.
Yeah.
There's no reason to do the bank shot. I can just, set up pitch meetings and go and pitch the movie as a movie. Hmm. So it's like I said earlier, like I really pick the stories that, fit the different mediums, like Halcyon. There's a world where anything can become anything, but Halcyon works best, I think, as a comic book. That's sort of what it wanted to be. Overwatch, because of its literary sort of inspirations, like I said, Thoreau and Grisham and Clancy, wanted to live as a novel.
Will there be more Alex Garnett?
I hope so. I think that's really up to the readers at this point. It's sort of out of my hands. But I have ideas, and I'm a big fan of Tom Clancy's work, and one of the things I really enjoy about his novels, is the fact that you could spend decades with these characters and watch them grow and evolve over time, that they weren't frozen in amber. And the idea of sort of following Alex you know, from the beginning of his career with the CIA, you know, and sort of seeing what becomes of him after the events of Overwatch, I would, you know, I'd really welcome that opportunity.
So I'm wondering if you do another Alex Garnett story, since he's, I hope this isn't giving away too much, he and his girlfriend apparently kaput. Could you write me into the next story and maybe picking up with his girlfriend? Because, boy, it sounded like the sex with her was incredible. So,
well, let me see what I can do.
Could I do that?
Would that turn it into science fiction, I wonder?
Horror. Probably horror.
Well played.
Because, I mean, I saw that there is a Judge Hotchkiss in the book. And, of course, the guy that brought us together, connected us, was a John Hotchkiss. I'm sure that's just a total coincidence. You just had no other names available to you.
You know, interestingly enough, John is under the impression that I named the character after him, and I had to tell him, no, actually, I named him after your wife. you know, no, I'm kidding. But
you had me for a second there. I was buying the bullshit.
You know, you really, it's funny. You write these novels, and you know, you got to name all these characters, and There's a lot of friends and family and coworkers and former coworkers who are named in the novel, and I put that in partially I got to name these characters, and you know, so I need to get the names from somewhere, and also it's a good test of who my friends really are.
yes, I get that entirely. If my wife ever read anything that I wrote, she would find herself in a number of books. Yes, I have slipped my wife's first name and my daughter's first name into a number of places. But because they never read anything I write, they will never know.
It is their loss.
Yes, it is. All right, so let's talk. We're running a little long here, and I don't want to keep it too long. You know, I don't want to leave poor Arrow, you know, strung up somewhere that he can't get out of until you come back.
He's always stuck.
So two more things I want to ask you about. First of all, let's talk about Arrow for a minute. How long have you been on the show?
Since the very beginning. I co-created it with Greg Berlanti and Andrew Kreisberg. So we've been, you know, you basically, like, we're in the second season of the show, but it takes about a year before you get on the air to launch a show, in terms of, you know, you start with the pitch and then go to the pilot and everything else. And that's a year-long process. So it's been like 3 years now.
Wow.
Yeah.
And are you going to stay with it another year?
That is my plan.
Good, good. It's fascinating to me. I, as a comic book guy from way back, but there's only so many hours in the day, and I did not get to watch – during the first season, I didn't get to watch an entire episode. Last summer, though, we flew to London, and who did we fly on? British Air. They had Arrow. You could watch, like, I don't know, 10 episodes. So
British Air.
I watched it over, and I watched it back, and I was like, wow, this is as good as people say it is.
Thank you.
It's very, very cool. Is there now knowing your comic background, and of course I know Berlanti's name, but is there a lot of pressure? Was there pressure at the beginning? Is there more or less pressure now to follow any arc from the comic itself, or are you play it a little looser there than?
You know, there hasn't been any pressure. You know, I think from Jump, we've always sort of said this is our version of Green Arrow, and it's going to take inspiration from the comics, but it's not going to follow the comics religiously. And part of the advantage of doing Green Arrow versus, let's say, Batman or Spider-Man is that, you know, his origin, Oliver Queen's origin and backstory, is not as set in stone as, you know, Spider-Man's or Batman's or Superman's. And we have license to deviate from the comics, and what we often do is sort of use the comics and the expectation that they create against the viewer, and sort of subvert those. That use the comic book to set up the expectations and then subvert the expectations. So there's an element of the show that I think is very surprising if you're familiar with the comics, and if you're not familiar with the comics, it just plays on its own merits.
Yeah, it's interesting. It probably would have been tougher for you guys had there not been 10 years of Smallville ahead of you, kind of setting a tone and a way of dealing with the character that breaks from the comics but is still kind of true to the spirit. And it's interesting. Have you watched many episodes of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Yes, I've watched several.
And
I'm a little bit behind, but I've watched many, many.
This is really the first time that Marvel has tried to do – well, in the modern age, there was a Spider-Man and a Hulk back in the 70s. Less said about probably the better. Although the Hulk was kind of fun. How are they doing things differently than you guys are? Because, again, they're dealing with – S.H.I.E.L.D. always kind of a secondary thing in the Marvel universe.
I think it's a different kind of show because, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. is a secondary kind of agency. So they're not tracking, like, the story of a hero, you know. On Arrow, we have a version of S.H.I.E.L.D. called Argus, which is sort of the DC Comics equivalent. And it's literally the difference between doing a show about Spider-Man and a show about S.H.I.E.L.D. and a show about Green Arrow and a show about Argus. Like, you know, our approach is just very different than it would be as if we were doing Argus, the TV show. I think it's also maybe the difference is that we're not tied into any other corner of the DC universe. You know, what happens in, like, Man of Steel doesn't affect Arrow, whereas that's obviously not the case with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. The whole point is that it exists in the same universe as the Marvel movies. The truth is, the similarities end after the idea that they're both quote unquote comic book shows. Mm-hmm. But they're very different animals, as a result.
And will there be connections? Now, in the fall, CW is adding another show, Gotham, kind of the early Batman. Will that show tie in with Arrow at all? Will it exist in the same kind of universe?
No, I don't think it will. I think for one thing, none of us involved with Arrow are involved with Gotham. And they're on separate networks.
I didn't realize.
Gotham will be on, I want to say, Fox or CBS.
It must be Fox, yeah, okay.
And we are on the CW. They won't connect. At least for now. I mean, as always, you know, we await our marching orders from, you know, people way above my pay grade.
I got it. And does it, I know it's fun for the fans when other characters show up in these series. It was fun when Green Arrow showed up in Smallville and when the Flash showed up in Arrow. And, of course, there is a Flash spinoff coming. Now, what about those two? They will.
I mean, okay. They'll interact because they exist in the same world, and Flash is spinning off of Arrow. We've already introduced Barry Allen, mm-hmm. And we're introducing other characters from the Flash in our next episode, which airs in 2 weeks. So there will be that connection. But again, that's all sort of in the family.
How cool for me, having watched the original Flash series 15, 20, 30, whatever. It was a long time ago that the John Wesley Shipp will have a role in The Flash.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah, it is.
When I found out about that, I was super excited. It's very, very, very cool.
He was great. As a matter of fact, I think that was one of the first times – I think it was early in my marriage when that aired, and it was one of the first times my wife sort of got the comic book thing because we would watch that, and it was like, oh, this is kind of cool. Yeah.
Yeah. It's – I love that show. I mean, I really love that show when it was on. I love the tip of the hat to having, you know, John on The Flash.
And so, where I was going with that was, are there, you know, do you guys get as excited to bring these other DC characters into the show?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. For us, it's always a thrill, it's always an opportunity to, you know, try something new and casting and costume design and just the cool factor of it. Yeah, we love doing that because we approach the show like fans. I mean, we're comic book fans ourselves, and we again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about the stuff I like to write. It's do we write the show that we want to watch? And that happens week in, week out, and we really watch it through a fan's eyes.
It seems that the design of the costumes for TV is almost as important or more important than the casting of the actor who plays it. Because, you know, when the shots of the full Flash outfit were spreading like wildfire, I'm sure everybody was like, well, okay, let's take a look. And it's like, okay, that's pretty cool, you know. And Arrows, I mean, the hood, the whole thing, it's very cool. And, you know, I know the women obviously love...
Yes, they love it when he's not wearing that costume.
Yes, yes, indeed. So, all right. All right, so the last thing I want to ask you about, and you've been very gracious with your time.
I appreciate you being interested.
I could keep talking to you for a while, but I know we both have jobs to get back to. But tell me about behind you, there's an interesting bulletin board. Do you want to take advantage of the video here and show us some things on your board?
Let me see what I got here, okay? So I've got some artwork by my 6-year-old daughter. This is a chart that I've been very bad about updating about returning cast members, so on Arrow, not regular cast members.
Okay.
This is a post-it about budgetary numbers for really early on in the season. Let's get rid of that. That's episodes 2, 3, and 4 from this season. I have no idea what this money is supposed to refer to. I really don't. So we're going to toss that. This is the schedule, the shooting schedule for episode 22 of the season of Arrow called Streets of Fire.
Has the NSA been through that, blacking it out? Is that what I'm seeing?
You can't see it because of the resolution, but basically the black there's white text over that black.
Oh, I see. I figured either the NSA or Warner Brothers had gone through there and said, okay, you can show this on camera, but they can't see this.
No, it's not. It's not redacted. Let me see if I can do this in a way that doesn't spoil, but like... Here, we'll do this.
Yeah, no spoilers, unless you want to.
Yeah, so it just has this kind of information.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
All
right. So we got that. I'm a very big Billy Joel fan, so that's an article about Billy Joel's charity concert a few months back at the Paramount Theater. This is a crew list that gives me all the names and phone numbers of everyone on the casting crew. Let's see here. This is a character named Whiplash. This is actually kind of cool. Brandon Braga and I did a Iron Man series called Iron Man versus Whiplash, and we created a new version of Whiplash, and they made an action figure out.
Oh, very cool.
So that's kind of cool. Right. This is our tentative production schedule for Arrow that tells me when we prep, when we shoot, and theoretically when we air. Let's see here. I got my Ryan Reynolds, Hal Jordan Green Lantern action figure.
Cool.
There's this, which I probably should show you because that project hasn't been announced yet.
Damn it.
It's supposed to be a secret. Writer contact information. One of our editors is a phenomenal baker, and she made me these peanut butter and chocolate crack things that were crazy good. The fan letter up there, Green Arrow action figure. The way up there. Can you see that?
We can, just see the bottom. There we go.
Oh, what was that? This is really cool. Our casting director commissioned these.
Oh, that's cool.
He made one for each of us on the writing staff. He had them commissioned, had them made. It's very, very cool. So I've got that up there. I just keep a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, that's very, very cool.
Yeah.
Seeing that, and I guess over your right shoulder at the top, is that more fan art, or is that your child?
I got my Green Lantern thing.
All the way up in the left corner, yeah.
That's more of my 6-year-old. And there's some here, too. There's my Big Belly Burger menu. That's the fast food chain on Arrow. I got my scanner that I do every. I need. Can you see that?
Your green lamp.
My green lamp. Everything green. I'm surrounded by all this stuff.
It's very cool. I mean, this is the great thing about video. We actually get into the writer's room, and so to speak, and we can see what you see. That's very cool.
Well, at some point we'll have to do this, and we'll do it from my home office, which has all manner of toys and whatnot.
Excellent. I'm in. Count me in for that. All right. Well, folks, listen. You can find Mark Guggenheim's first novel, Overwatch. in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching on the site, MrMedia.com, somewhere below the video, either over there or over there, depending on where I decide to put it, is the cover of the book. You can click on it right now. If you're a Kindle kind of or an iBook guy, you can have it delivered immediately as an ebook to you, or you can have it physically sent to you. I'm sure Amazon will be happy to send it via drone within 30 minutes or less. Or it's free, I think. So there's that. And, of course, keep watching Arrow every Wednesday night at 8 on the CW. Yes. Watch for The Flash in the fall. Do you have a website? Are you on any social media, Twitter, Facebook, any of that stuff?
I'm on Tumblr as Mark Guggenheim. I'm on Facebook as Mark Guggenheim. And my Twitter is M. Guggenheim.
Okay. So you're not going to tell us that you're on MySpace as Greg Berlanti or anything?
That would be very, very funny. But no, I probably won't.
Okay. Well, Mark, it was great talking to you. Fascinating work that you've created and stuff going on in your office. Thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure.
Good talking to you. Thanks, man.
He spent years pushing the corporate suits, their rules, and their laws to the edge. Wait till you hear what he's like when he makes his own rules. The Don Geronimo Show.
Yearly subscriptions still available. Also available in quarterly or monthly packages. The Don Geronimo Show. Every Monday through Friday from 3 to 5 Eastern, noon to 2 Pacific. Live right here on the Rel Network. Hi, this is Buzz Burbank in the Buzz Burbank Newsroom, preparing for you another Buzz Burbank News and Comment. Do you like good stories? Boy, I sure do. I turn over a lot of stones each day to make sure I don't miss the best ones. Sure, some make me angry and some make me sad and some make me laugh, and isn't that what makes us human? I'm proud of the fact that I pack more news into my 10 or 15 minutes a day than the evening news does in a half hour. It's a free podcast at BuzzBurbank.com, or you can subscribe free at iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or get it on any RSS device. It's like a newspaper for your head. It's Buzz Burbank News and Comment, another Realm Network presentation. Weekday mornings right here on the Realm Network.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk, and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said that they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
And what you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
Oh, yeah. Hey, these are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot.
Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
Resistance is futile. It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights. Just a Minute with Joe Ardinger.
Like most people living in California, I'm deluding myself that I have the flu. But we all know it's really radiation from Fukushima. Or just the flu.
To hear the rest of this minute, to sample Joe's other minutes, and to subscribe to his newest ones, visit RealmNetwork.com. That's RELMNetwork.com. Just a Minute with Joe Ardinger, another great Realm Network production. Wednesday afternoons, right here on the Realm Network.
The preceding presentation was brought to you by the Realm Network.